This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the March 30th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, joined as always by at DRF Formulator Mike Hogan and our special guest on the show for this year, Jonathan Kinchin. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Doing good, doing good. Hello, everyone.
We're going to have a couple of special guests on the show today, and we're going to start off with one of my favorite guests personally. I love the energy he brings to the show, as well as his fantastic racing bona fides. He's also a world traveler, which is something that's always interesting. I'm talking about Daily Racing Form's own Marcus Hirsch. Marcus, how are you today?
I'm fine, Pete. Fantastic energy. I like that. I'm no Jeb Bush, I guess.
low energy.
Sorry.
Perhaps you haven't been through racing politics. No. Only racing politics, and even that we keep to an absolute minimum. But let's hear a little bit about your travels. I imagine this past weekend is one of your. Am I correct in assuming that it's one of your busiest of the year between the trips, the trip that you just made, and all the action going back on at the fairgrounds?
It was unbelievably busy. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I slept so little last week when I was in Dubai. I'm not usually jet lagged when I came back, but it's been pretty brutal the last couple of days. I've totally dysregulated. I think a couple, like Thursday, I went out to the track at 6 and I didn't really work until 10:30 at night. I mean, this would be really awful if this were a real job. But I wanted to, it seems weird to give up the fairgrounds analysis after doing it the whole week, the last week, you know, especially with the weekend of the Derby. So I insisted on doing that, but that might have been a bridge too far in the end.
Am I correct though that assuming late in a meet when you're doing analysis, so much of it's coming from your notes that the handicapping part of the equation isn't as crazy as, say, early on in a meet? It's more just a question of finding the time to write and come up with coherent words and string them together?
I mean, yeah, it's not that much different for me. Plus, they piled so many races onto the end of that meet. They had, you know, like 14, 15 and race cards the last 3 days. It was brutal. Plus, I just had, to be honest, I had a terrible fairgrounds meet. I had a great meet with my selections last year. And this year, I never hit my stride at any point for more than like 2 days at a time. So, I felt like I'm doing these 15 races, and like I'll be lucky if I have 3 winners on top out of these.
Hey, that's not a bad percentage, really. You know, if you're knowing some of the prices that you throw in there.
I really don't know what it was. It was a situation where a lot of the time it wasn't even surprising because I felt just kind of lost at sea. And I know all the permutations of the meet and the actors, and you know, I've got a good handle on what happens on a day to day basis. You know, I knew when the track was biased a certain way and when it was having a slow, weird period. But it's still like even putting it all together, it just was brutal. Anyway. It was an incredibly busy week, but a very cool night of racing over there at Maidan, and I felt privileged, you know, to get to be there, even though when you're running around like crazy, it's a little different than just taking it all in from a different perspective.
I have questions for each of the three of you about the big race on the big night. Of course, we're talking about the Dubai World Cup, where California Chrome took his star turn. He put on the show that many of us were hoping to see over there. Marcus, I'll start with you with a very simple question. Is California Chrome a great horse?
Well, he's greater than he was on Friday, in my opinion. I guess some people already thought he was great. I don't think he's great necessarily, but I do think that he is better than just good. He needed to win that race, in my mind, to elevate himself to a different level. Now, I know other people felt differently. He's a Derby Preakness winner, and he did run a big race in the Breeders' Cup Classic when he was a 3-year-old, when he finished third. But to just win that race, it made him closer to great. I still don't think he's great. If you look at the field in the World Cup, a lot of horses did not run very well that night. Moutage is a nice horse, all right, but he was eighth in the Derby, fourth in the Belmont, and hadn't run very well in two starts this winter. He finished second. Opportunity probably would have been second without all the ground loss, Opportunity is a very good horse. I don't think anybody's ever mistaken him for a top class horse. So, yeah, California Chrome ran a tremendous race. He probably ran between that and his third in the Breeders' Cup Classic. But he won, and he got the big race win that he needed. Closer to great, not great for me.
Jonathan, actually, before I ask Jonathan the question I was going to ask him, I'm just curious, Jonathan or Mike, if you have anything contrary to what Marcus is saying, or if you think he nailed it with his assessment of where Chrome is in the pantheon of American racing.
Well, not like I'm that young, but as a semi-young racing fan, being heavily involved for like the last, 10 years, it's the word great is kind of hard for me to assign just because I feel like, the greats of my time might not be the greats in the whole historical landscape of racing. So it's a hard word for me to assign. I'll say he's pretty damn good. Winning the Derby, winning the Preakness, third in the Breeders' Cup. He's one of the greatest. He's won the greatest stakes on turf. Longevity. He's five now, winning the Dubai World Cup. So I don't know. It's close. It's pretty darn close, like Marcus said, to being great. But I would err on the side of pretty damn good.
Mike, you're a well-known Chromie. Where do you stand in this discussion?
I guess it depends on how you define great. I think he's clearly a deserving Hall of Famer. And if that is your criteria, then yes, I think it fits. But, I think what we're all talking about is there are Hall of Famers and then there are ones even a little higher level than that, the true greats of the sport. I'm not sure he's quite up there with those. I kind of agree with Marcus's assessment and Jonathan's too. But he's certainly a deserving Hall of Famer, and he's a lot better horse than I think some people gave him credit for, especially after that debacle that happened last year with his whole campaign.
I'm going to go out of order, actually, and I'm going to ask Mike the next question. I like the idea of bringing the Hall of Fame into the discussion, and I think sort of the next obvious question when we were trying to figure out where California Chrome fits, I'll ask you another difficult and unfair question, Mike. American Pharoah or California Chrome?
Well, I think American Pharoah. He seemed certainly more brilliant. On his best day, maybe Chrome was as good, but consistently American Pharoah was just much more brilliant.
Either of you guys want to cast a vote for Chrome in that discussion? Because I'm kind of with Mike.
No thanks.
All right.
You know where I stand.
Jonathan, let me ask you, what do you expect we're going to see from California Chrome the rest of this year?
Oh, man. Obviously the end goal would probably be the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think if Art Sherman had his way, it would be a conservative, intelligent approach. Unfortunately, I'm not sure if he's going to have the only say there, so I'm a little bit concerned of what might happen with the horse. If you don't know what I mean and you can't read between the lines, as far as I'm going to go.
That's the podcast version of a subtweet, folks.
Johnson,
I'm going to say it. Hands up, Mr. Martin. Hands up.
Yeah, just stay away. I'm a sportsman. I'd be excited to see him, if they decided they wanted to try to run him in the Arlington Million or something crazy like that. I mean, great. That's great. It'd be exciting to watch. But I just feel like it's not really fair to the horse. And it's, I don't know. We'll see. I'd hope to see him at Santa Anita for the Classic. Anything in between, I'll just be happy when he's running.
Marcus, I want to ask you one more question about Dubai, and then I want to move on and talk about the fairgrounds a little bit more. We could have spent the whole show today with you, but in the interest of your time and the week you came back and lots of the other interesting stuff coming on, we're only going to hang on to you for another 5 or 10 minutes here. But the other horse I wanted to ask you about, what you mentioned it before, the second-place finisher, Moutage. What are we expecting to happen with him next? There's some talk about him coming for a North American campaign.
Yeah, I did speak to Mike Dukat right after the race, who I know pretty well, and he said he definitely wants to bring the horse to the States, which makes perfect sense. He's a dirt horse, and you know, he's run three times. He's had a pretty measured campaign, and the long break wouldn't want to put him away until Dubai again next year. But I don't know if he thinks of him in terms of being a Breeders' Cup Classic kind of horse. I do think he would like to pick off a grade one. And, you know, he could run in a race if they wanted to do it sooner rather than later. He could run in a race like the Stephen Foster. He's been to Churchill before, did run that grade in the Derby. Or perhaps even more enticing would be to wait until a little later in the summer and go for, like, if you went to Saratoga, you could run him twice. You could even keep him around for the Jockey Club Gold Cup, like running three races. But if everything goes as planned, he will show up at some point, and it will be in the eastern half of the country. I mean, Art Sherman said specifically to me afterward, if he has his way, it'll California Chrome will race two more times in the Pacific Classic and in the Breeders' Cup Classic, and that would be it. And I think that'd be fine. I think that, you know, I'd love to see him in both of those spots.
It'll be fascinating to follow these horses throughout the year. And it's also going to be very interesting to see as the year goes on how this current crop of three-year-olds performs as they get to face their elders a little bit later in the year. We had a key three-year-old prep race at Fairgrounds over the weekend, the Louisiana Derby. Gunrunner, once again, getting the job done in what I thought was visually kind of a nice performance. Marcus, what did you think of Gunrunner, and what are you hearing about how he came out of the race?
Well, I haven't talked to Aspie Soon or anything about how he came out of the race. I thought he ran fine. He's a very solid horse. He got a great trip in that race, but a horse has to make the most of a great trip, and he definitely did. Not just that, but he ran a big race in the Risen Star coming back from winter break, and he avoided, you know, bouncing or regressing off that. I don't know how much better he ran, really, second time out than first, but he stayed nine furlongs, at least better than several other horses in the race. He stamped himself as one of the two best horses coming out of New Orleans this winter. I mean, I watched the race. It was like 3 a.m. over there, and then I watched it one other time, but I just went back and watched it again before coming on with you guys. And I think there's a widespread belief that Mo Tom couldn't have run any better than second. He hadn't had another just completely ridiculous trip. But I disagree with that. I think he was just hitting his best stride. And I mean, it looks like Gunrunner is going to win by open length because of the way it shook out. But Mo Tom was going to finish so much better than the horses in second and third, Dazzling Gem and Tom's Ready, that I'm not totally convinced he wouldn't have made it extremely close. I'm a Mo Tom fan. I really like that horse. And I know, people on Pedigree wonder how far he wants to run Uncle Mo out of Rubiano Mare, but he has a lot of stamina on the female side of his pedigree. And if you look at him, he's a marathon runner type shaped horse. I watched him train several times this winter, and he's a great galloper. He second time around, he's really strong. I think he's got no stamina limitations, and he hasn't run fast yet. He hasn't put up a big number, but in the LeCompte, I don't think he could have run fast the way the race shaped up. And then he's just had completely awful trouble in his last two starts, and not much pace really in the Louisiana Derby. Is he going to win the Kentucky Derby? I'm not sure, but I do think it's weird because he's such a huge, obvious trip horse, but I do think he's still going to end up being underrated coming out of those races.
Well, you led me right into the question I was going to ask Mike. And for those who haven't seen the Louisiana Derby and the trip that we're talking about, really go to the DRF site, go to YouTube right now and pull it up. To quote our Twitter friend Nick Kling, it's a trip reminiscent of the Donner Party. I mean, this is not your average stopped for a couple of seconds here. This is a horse who I think you just can't even know what would have happened next. Mike, you put the question out on Twitter, would Mo Tom have won the race? What feedback have you gotten from that Twitter poll, and what's your own opinion about that question?
Well, you're right. I tweeted it out yesterday. There's about 4 hours left as we're recording this in the poll, and so far 266 people have voted. 70% are saying no, Gunrunner would have won anyway, but 30% are saying Motom would have won the race had he gotten a clean trip. I don't know. I've watched the race a few times, and I keep going back and forth. It would be close. It certainly would be much closer than the second place finisher was to Gunrunner. They're both, I mean, I think Marcus put it right. Those are the two horses that I want out of the Louisiana Derby or the Risen Star. And he may very well have gotten up and beaten Gunrunner. I know certainly trainer Tom Amos was livid, to say the least, after the race, so much so that he pulled Corey Lannery off of his mount later in the day, who knows what happens going forward if there's a different jockey on Motom in the future, or if they've made amends since that. But I know right after the race, Tom Amos was not happy with the ride at all.
Jonathan, I want to ask you, there's an old handicapping saw that there are no trips in slow races. The winning buyer figure for the Louisiana Derby was only a 91. Keeping that in mind, will any of these horses be on your ticket when it comes time for the Kentucky Derby?
Obviously we have a lot more things to sort out to decide that. I mean, here's the thing about it is, I kind of liked Motom's race, and he would be a horse I'd be interested in betting back, but not anymore. And the reason is like, I was interested in him because he was closing into 113 and change, but now the world is going to overbet him based on the trip. And so the price that I should get for him closing into a slow pace where I think some people might've missed, no one's going to miss it anymore. And so now the horse, and it happens a lot, I think, when you do a lot of trip stuff, is like you fall in love with the horse for the right reason. The public falls in love with the horse for the wrong reason. But it doesn't matter. Your price is still going to be crushed either way. So, if the Derby was run tomorrow, I don't really want any of these horses out of here. Maybe Tom's ready a little bit just because I think he'll still be 40-50 to 1. But Gunrunner and Motom, I would probably fade at this point. One thing I do want to say that I've learned about Fairgrounds, and I'm sure Marcus could talk about this a little bit more, is, you know, watching Dan Illman's old video from a long time ago about trips, I started, you know, as a young handicapper, watching horses switch leads late in races and taking it as a negative. One of the things I've noticed about Fairgrounds, with the stretch being as long as it is, a lot of horses switch leads late, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're tired. It's just they've been on their right lead forever because the stretch is so long. And so I'm trying to be a little bit more objective on Gunrunner switching his leads late.
You mean switching back to the wrong lead late?
Absolutely. That's what of course. Yeah.
Just to clarify that. Is that something you've noticed, Marcus, as well? Is that something that you put much faith in? A lot of really good handicappers don't even look at lead change stuff. What's your general opinion on the issue and about this question that Jonathan raises specifically?
It's not really something I've even noticed, but it's a legitimate point that, and the reasoning behind it that Jonathan mentioned makes sense. One thing that is interesting about Fairgrounds with that long stretch is how poorly late runners generally do, especially in route races there. There's a natural assumption that a horse like Motom has an advantage, get everything sorted out and has a chance to close, but that doesn't really happen to be the case. I mean, I don't necessarily, in this instance, I don't hold Gunrunner's late lead change against him so much, but he's a horse that I'm probably, I mean, I don't think he's going to finish in the top five in the Derby. I'm sure he'll prove me wrong, but that's one horse that I'm probably, probably the only horse out of this race that I have an interest in Kentucky is Motown, to be honest. I mean, I thought Dazzling Gem kind of exceeded my expectations, but he and Tom's Ready, just they were the ones that just kind of hung around to the end. You know, Forever Mo didn't stay, Candy My Boy didn't stay, I didn't think he would. I don't think there was a huge amount of substance to the race.
Well, I understand Jonathan's point about so often these what we call international bad trip horses get over bet the next time. I wonder if a 20-horse Kentucky Derby with a few horses coming in with hype and perhaps multiple trip horses could be the exception, where a horse coming with a terrible trip out of a slow race could still be that really big price. The great thing is we don't have to decide now. We can wait until we hear the vibes and everything going on in the days before the Derby, and we don't even have to decide to make a bet until 2 minutes before the big day, the big race on the big day on the first Saturday in May. So that's all stuff to pay attention to. Marcus, I want to let you go, but just the last thing before I do, you working on anything right now you're excited about that you want to mention, or just let us know sort of where you're heading next.
I'm working at Hawthorne. 1, 2, 3 is for Friday. So that's enough said about that.
Well, thank you for taking the time today. Always appreciate having you on the show, and hopefully we'll get you back real soon.
I'll be on the Triple Crown Trail soon enough. I've enjoyed being here. Thanks a lot, Pete.
Thank you, my man. All right, Marcus Hirsch, fantastic always to have him on, getting his insights from around the world of thoroughbred racing. Our next guest, we're actually going to keep the topic briefly here on the Louisiana Derby, when we bring in our next guest. If you read my work, you know this guy. He's one of the biggest stars in the book I wrote, The Winning Contest Player. He's a former NHC Tour champion. He's a former trainer who had numerous accolades when that was his chosen profession. He's also a tireless advocate for horse rescue, and that's a topic we'll get into a little bit later in the show. But here's the thing you might not know about Brent Sumja. He's also very good friends with Tom Amos, for whom he used to work. And I don't want you to talk out of school, Brent, so you can just give one of those athlete at the end of the game answers. You know, we had a good game, they had a good game, everybody had a good game, and just, you know, talk but not say anything if I'm asking you to talk out of school. But I am very curious about that question that Mike mentioned before about Tom Amos and Corey Lannery and who might be riding Mo Tom in his next start. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, good morning to all of you. I really enjoyed listening to Marcus. I've never met Marcus in person, but I'm looking forward to it because I feel like he and I have a lot of the same opinions when I'm looking at social media. He and I seem to agree on a lot of stuff, so I look forward to meeting him, and it was interesting to hear his take. I also want to talk to Jonathan about who he likes in the Derby at some point, because I might have to put a little friendly challenge to him.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
So
we haven't had a podcast challenge in a while.
I talked to Tom. I know Tom well enough. I've known him since 1989. I know him well enough to not have talked to him that day. I was walking down the hill to you know, doing some exercise, and I thought, you know, now it's been 24 hours. It's probably a good time where I can squeeze in a little text, and all I said is, the horse okay? Because as a trainer and being on the backside, and anyone who's owned horses or been around them, those things happen, you know, and it's awful that it happened twice in a row. It's just, it's, you know, the odds of that are, I mean, it's like you're watching a replay. I was telling some friends, I was in Scottsdale when the first one happened, and they were watching, and they don't really follow horse racing, but I told them yesterday, I said, you're not going to believe this, but if I put those races up, it's almost like you guys probably couldn't tell the difference which race it was, you know? So I know he was, you know, he felt bad and publicly stated that it was unprofessional, but to be honest with you, the reason, when I was training horses after a while, I had my assistant saddle every horse. I never went in wind pictures. I never went down to talk to the jockey afterwards, good or bad. I stayed in the corner of the grandstand by myself, and it's because I didn't have that in me to not go down there and get emotionally involved in the situation, you know, and you need some time to think about it, you know. So for him to do that in a $400,000 race that he's never won at his home track, I kind of can really relate to it that, you know, what can you do? But I do have an idea of what he's going to do, but it's not something I can share.
Sure.
It's just, you know, it's something he's going to think out.
Let me jump in, Brent, because just now I'm looking on Twitter, and according to the Courier Journal, they're saying Lannery will retain the mount.
Okay.
I don't know if we have anybody on the DRF side that's reported it, but I'm sure, you know, obviously the news is getting out there. So
Marcus would have had it.
Tom's owners are really great, because he just said that they were leaving it up to him, which, you know, whenever I go anywhere to do anything and someone else whose profession it is doing it with me, you know, whether you're getting a haircut, whether whatever it is, I just look at them and say, look, when people told me how to train their horse, it didn't always come out so well. So you do what you do. I'm here because I trust you, you know, and he's got great owners who I know are allowing him to do that. That can only be beneficial for the horse.
That's great. All right. Now, we didn't really have you here to talk about this. That was just a little segue slash add-on. We had you on here because of the weekend you had last, it was last Saturday, when you not only won the contest on NHCqualified.com to punch your ticket back to Las Vegas and the NHC, you were also one of several well-known contest players. The list keeps growing. Who hit the Rainbow Six. And you had a particularly interesting approach to the Rainbow Six as well. But let me start off by saying, when you woke up on Saturday morning, did you have visions that this was going to be a great day?
I think we all do, no matter what. You know, if you don't have those visions, then you probably shouldn't be doing it. You never expect to be in that situation, but you have to be ready for it at all times. And when you're playing contests and betting cash and involved in a Rainbow Six, you know, things kind of change along the way. And I'm not a big hedger. You know, it's not something that I'll do it literally like 1 out of 100 times when other people would do it. But in that particular case, towards the end, it got to be where, you know, something I still don't understand, and maybe someone can answer this question, how do they not put out the payouts for that bet? How is that possible that they don't post the payouts on that bet?
That is a very good question that I haven't seen anybody do any research on. I suppose it's possible. I mean, you know, this is racing, so the answer is probably because they're dealing with really antiquated technology that maybe has a problem when it comes to parsing the bet down to the 20-cent interval. That would be my guess, but that's all that is. That's a good question for somebody in mutuals at the Stronach Group for sure.
I was just curious because I've never really seen that before. You know, you kind of know what you're looking at. I had no idea. You know, it's not something in that case that I could really figure out. I was way out of the ballpark. I was thinking along the lines of 150. I've talked to other people who I have way more respect for in terms of knowing that sort of thing, and they were thinking 75, so I realized I was way out of the park. But there were two horses in that last leg that I didn't have that I was a little, like at that point, you know, I wasn't worried about them at all earlier, but of course you get to that point and you change your mind a little bit. So I did actually bet two of the horses that were in double digits to make sure that I would take something back.
I think that's only fair when you're up to bat for the kind of score that can certainly make your betting life better for the year at the least. If it ain't life-changing money, it's real nice bankroll. In terms of your gambling scores, Brett, where does this hit rank? Is it something that's important to you, or is it just another win?
Oh, no. For individually, you know, not sharing a ticket with anyone, which I have a very funny story about, I'll go into another time. I was in on a ticket that a guy, you know, he said, oh, it's Martin Luther King or whatever it was. It was some holiday on Monday, and so he didn't want to – he was putting the bet in for us, and I had called the guy in Florida, and we were all good, and it would have paid $330,000, and we would have all split it, but nobody hit it. So he didn't want to put the horse in that was washy in the post parade at the first leg. So that would have been my favorite. I won't say his name. He's a good guy. But individually, on my own, that was my biggest one in terms of a pick six. I've had pick fours that added up to more than that because I had them a lot.
Sure.
But that individually as a pick six was my biggest one. I had one at Tampa where I had the only one in the pool and one at Golden Gate that were both about 70,000.
Now, who am I to tell you what to do when you put together this ticket that you know, you walked away with all that money and I was, you know, at the fast food rice and beans joint down the block eating dinner on Saturday night?
Oh, but, I've been there plenty of times.
But I will say this, given the amount of money that you put in, which I agree was a worthy investment, I just said on the Bick show that for me, like as a horse player, whatever your sort of max investment is, that's what you should have been, you know, willing to make in that bet, assuming you like the sequence at all. But I was just curious that you went about it caveman style, as opposed to weighting your opinions a little bit more in the hopes to maybe catch it two or three different times. Is that something that you gave any thought to? And just tell me in general your typical approach to constructing multi-race bets like that.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I never, ever do the ABC. You know, I tried it years ago. I read Steve Crisp's book, you know, and it just didn't work for me. You know, it's too many times that, you know, I just don't feel good enough that I can qualify an A, a B, and a C like that. You know, I just don't feel confident in it. Whereas on the other end, I feel very confident that I can qualify a D or F, if you were going to put it in those circumstances, sure. You know. So when I went to look at it, of course, just like any pick four, if I feel it's chalky, I don't care, you know, what the investment should be. I'm probably not going to play. Gotcha. But I think that was an easy one to look at without even looking at it. All you had to do was see Gulfstream Park, turf racing, full fields. I mean, that, yep. If you haven't been watching their meet, that in itself is enough to just say, you know what, there's no way this is going to chalk out. It just doesn't happen there. So that really was all I really needed to know, was the amount of entries in Gulfstream Park when I woke up and looked at it.
Now, the other big win on the day, you know, maybe not the same financially, but perhaps emotionally, still a significant win. What did it mean to you to end up on top on NHC Qualify?
Was Jonathan Kinchin in that contest?
I wasn't in that one.
Oh, man, then it doesn't mean quite as much, but it was still a you know, because if you're shooting, you got to shoot at the top. That's it. I'll tell you, back to Amos really quick. When I first started training, I was, you know, Northern California, didn't know what to do. And he says to me, you go find the leading trainer and you claim a horse off of him immediately. And I was like, okay, well, the leading trainer was Jerry Hollendorfer. And Jerry has a little bit of a temper. So it was a Friday night and I was sitting on the front side and I'm claiming a 6250 non-winners of two lifetime, which is about his number 179 horse in his barn of 400. And I turn into the test barn after the horse runs about fifth, which if I was him, I'd be jumping up and down that some idiot took it. And I'm sitting there watching him cool out, you know, I hear him come around the corner. Who took my horse? I'm like, oh, thanks a lot, Amos. I really appreciate that. He comes over to me, how many horses do you have? And I said, one. He goes, well, when you get more, I'm picking every last one of them from you. I was like, okay, that's good. So the funny part of the story is he and I end up at 5 o'clock in the morning on the rail at Bay Meadows for 15 years together, talking, becoming really good friends, and watching his progress down there. It's been amazing because if you knew Jerry, you knew he could go anywhere and do those sort of things. So that was a really nice ending to watch all that.
Oh, that's pretty crazy. Now, wait, what got you on talking about the dwarf in the first place here? We were talking about
just from having Tom tell me to go claim a horse off him, but we were talking about the NHC. I'm sorry, I got sidetracked when Jonathan wasn't in the contest. It kind of took a little of the luster out of it. But, you know, I literally, and this has happened to me before, I entered that contest. I think there were 24 entries left, and it was about 3 minutes to post to the first leg of it. I think it was at Oaklawn. And I said to myself, you know, I studied this Rainbow Six. I basically have five of the 12 races that I already know what I'm doing. And I just literally put in one entry. And it goes back to something I had said earlier about, I saw Christian Helmers after the NHC, the day one or two, whatever. I was in the consolation, you know. And too many entries is, it just doesn't force your hand. You know, to have that one entry the other day in this thing, it's the gun-to-head mentality of choose your horse, you know. Stop spreading out and, okay, you hit it on this ticket, you have it on this ticket, and you keep coming up. It's like when I used to play poker, you know. You have to go and get chips immediately in the first hour or be out, because the guy who's in the middle doing the math gets nothing in the end, you know.
Jonathan, that sounds like a lot like your approach, maybe why your approach to playing two tickets works so well. You take some of that guesswork out by playing your two tickets the same as much as possible. So do you agree with what Brent's saying?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And what he's saying is, you know, the gun to head mentality. What I've kind of done is done that with two entries. Like if I love a horse, gun to head, I just play the horse on both of them. So I completely agree. I've never been the guy that, when you look at my tickets, you look at my two tickets, you won't see, you know, two different horses on every spot the whole way down, which a lot of guys, you'll see that. And you won't see that with me. And I would imagine you wouldn't see the same from Brent either.
You know, I actually do that, but I did learn that from Jonathan. I look and I'd be like, the first day that I see, I'm like, how does this guy have this horse on both tickets? You know? And then I come to the realization, It's not maybe that he loved it that much, but you can't afford to not have it on boat tickets is what I started to realize, you know? And I really learned that from watching guys, you know, that were finishing ahead of me. You know, when I first came into it, I had a little bit of luck, and then, you know, you realize you have a lot to learn about it, and no matter who it is, you're always learning from people. And that was one of the things I picked up from these guys is that, you know, if you like a horse that much, you got to go in, especially early. You know, I've learned it early in contests. You can't take short prices. It's the road to nowhere.
Now, Brett, you were talking about packing on the sort of pre-show interview we did. Are you by chance packing to go to Las Vegas for the Horse Player World Series?
There's a very good possibility of that. It's funny. It's something I've not had any success in, but I think I have a little bit better approach to it this year. I think in the past I would overstudy. You know, I literally haven't looked at one race. I don't think it's the type of contest that you can. I think you have to take it kind of on the run, and I'm hoping that will work for me because that's what I'm going to do this year. I literally am going to just do a tiny bit of organizational work and no handicapping until I sit down there on tomorrow morning.
All right, so you can hopefully be one of the many people, and I want other podcast listeners who are out there in Las Vegas listening to the show. I know there are several of you. Send us updates on Twitter. Let us know how you're doing. Give us a snapshot of the leaderboard. Contests like this leaderboard doesn't matter too much, I wouldn't say, until day three, but always interesting to get a snapshot of the leaderboard at the end of the day. Now, Brent, I know you got to go, so I don't want to keep you too long, but you mentioned you had some idea of a derby challenge, perhaps, for the guys here today. What did you have in mind?
Yeah, let's do it all around, and who do we like, and let's go, how about if we go just finishing ahead of the other guy's horse, and maybe a dinner, or some type of nice dinner, or some type of little wager.
I like it. I'd say we should do it in Saratoga, but you're pathologically afraid of the place.
Well, yeah, it's not my favorite place. But if you had the experience I had there of having to sit in the owner's box with a suit and tie and 138 degrees, you'd agree with me.
I agree, but see, these days you don't have to do that. You could just come. You could be sitting with us in the secret spot at the paddock bar with the fan going okay. Above the head. Desiree bringing us drinks. You know, it doesn't. It's not all about, you know, stuffy and wear a jacket and tie in the boxes at Saratoga. There's a lot of ways.
All right, then I will have to give it another try. I just get to go first for my pick. That's all I
okay,
ask.
Okay, so what are we doing? We're just going to pick one horse. All right, The interesting thing here, Mike and I will chime in later, but the interesting thing here is the head-to-head of Brent versus Jonathan. We'll let Brent go first.
I'm taking Motom.
Okay, Jonathan, you need to pick one horse to finish ahead of Motom in the Kentucky Derby.
Don't chalk out on me, buddy.
Right what I was about to say it too. Now I got all interested.
You got in your head. This is the poker player in him coming out. He's intimidating.
So here's my
you.
Thought, really quick. My thought is this: the style of Motom is kind of a cheating bet because I don't know how you guys feel, but I feel he's going to be running on at the end, hopefully unblocked, and I feel like he's going to run in the top five, like no matter what. I just feel he will, you know. And that's kind of when I say horse for horse, it makes that horse, even though he'll be 15, 20, 30 to 1, whatever he's going to be, it just makes that a good horse head-to-head in my mind.
Okay, that's a smart approach.
So I like that. So here's what I'll do. I was gonna go a little chalky, not too chalky. I wasn't going to go Mohamed or anything like that. I actually think he's going to lose this weekend. But
I
actually look at the Derby the other way, where I want a horse that's going to be forward to stay on because he won't be in trouble. I'll take Cupid.
I like that.
All right, Jonathan, let's keep it. Mike, you want to throw a horse into the mix for this conversation, and then I'll go last?
Sure. Well, I'll take the other Baffert, More Spirit, figuring he will probably be mid-pack and hopefully will run on.
I like that. That was who I was going to say. So in the interest of not taking any more time on this, I will be the chalk-eating weasel. I will take Nyquist.
All right, dinner in Saratoga?
dinner at Saratoga. You got to come up for the contest. The details haven't been announced yet. Rumors that it's going to be a live bank thing, but you're going to know half the people in that room, and we're going to have a great old time up at Saratoga. Brent, we got to have you on the show again. I thought that was really fun. I loved hearing those stories from the training days, and I specifically want to have you on to talk about certain handicapping angles that relate to trainers at some point, because I can't think of anybody better than you to speak to the sort of coming together of the handicapping side and the horseman side. So we'll do that next time.
I appreciate all you guys' time, and good luck to everyone. Jonathan, you going to Horse Fair World Series?
No, I'll be there in spirit. I'm playing with a friend, but I'm playing from home.
I got
you. Yeah,
I got you. All right, buddy. Good luck to everyone. It was great talking to you.
All right, travel safe. Right, we'll be talking soon.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All right, there you have it. Brent Sumption, Marcus Hirsch, thanks to those guys both for coming on the show today. That was really interesting to get to hear the perspectives of another top contest player. Jonathan, you've clearly gotten in the man's head.
Oh, you know what? He's he's one guy. I'll tell you this quick story. Then I actually want to tell a Horse Player World Series advice piece real fast. But
yeah, I love it.
So Sumja was the first name that I recognized from your book. That was it was in the finals with me of my first like main tournament, and I was so like nervous. Like when I saw his name, I was like, "Oh my God, this guy Brent Sumja's in here. I've got no damn shot." I was so distraught and thrown off. And then I won that tournament. I did well. And then I met Sumja at Horse Player World Series 2 years ago or last year. Last year, and he was amazing. He was awesome. We sat next to each other at dinner, and we've been buddies ever since. My Hawthorne win. We hung out that night because he hit the pick five that day too, and he's great. Unbelievable opinion, really good horse player. All the people that are going in the Horse Player World Series, me and my buddy Nick Tamaro came up with this little strategy that we did last year that I thought – we didn't realize it until the last day, unfortunately. But there are so many races in that tournament, and there's no place really for short-priced horses. What we did on the final day – was we sat in our hotel room, we set our iPhones to a 1 minute timer, and we handicapped for 1 minute every race. And we looked at it and we handicapped it for one, and we decided, are we in this race? Is it a maybe, or is it a no way we're playing it? And that made our lives so much easier on that final day. And we actually made a run and finished 22nd on that last day. And I really think that that was part of it. It's just too many races at the handicap. It's impossible to do what you normally do. Just get an idea of what races you want to focus on, do it quickly, and then just focus on those. So that was one thing that we did last year that was awesome.
That's a good approach. That's going in the winning contest player part two when we ever get to that one.
It's funny because that is an approach that our buddy Jake Luft talks about, and he calls it the Malcolm Gladwell blink approach.
Sure.
Where you look at the race and you say, okay, who's the winner? You know? Simple, basic, like don't dive into deep stats and don't dive into replays and just look at it on paper, 10 seconds even, who's your winner?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the windows long term, that's a recipe to get your head kicked in. In a situation like the Horse Player World Series, though,
yep.
I definitely, especially because in the Horse Player World Series, I mean, to me, Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're basically eliminating horses under, what, 6, 8, 10 to 1?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I that's hard for me because I'm such a chalky, you know, weasel myself. But, yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that in that tournament, you know, I think Duke said it best. I mean, you want to have – Duke Matisse said it best. You need to hit, like, 3 10-to-1 shots a day to have a shot in that thing. And, you know, obviously there's a place for a 5-to-2 shot late in a tournament. You know, you don't ever want to turn away those points because how often in the last race do you wish you had that 5-to-2 shot? But it's a different format than you know, that when you'd be used to playing online. It's a different format when, you know, than Saratoga or these other live win place tournaments that you play in, because, you know, there's usually a limit to what you can play. And this one, there's like eight tracks, I think, or 7 tracks. It's kind of like the NHC, but they're all optional. You know, they're all optional as well. There's no mandatories like there is in the NHC. So it makes it a lot more challenging.
Well, before, you know, one thing I forgot to do with Brent is he's such an advocate of horse rescue, and this is a concept I know that you guys both believe in, too, from your time in the game. So I just want to mention that Brent is a huge believer, and he puts his money where his mouth is, too, as you'll read if you read the article I wrote about Brent and Duke and Dave Gutfreund all hitting the Rainbow Six. Brent went ahead and listed the four rescue organizations where he was going to be making a $1,000 donation each to. And the idea is just that when you have a big score, and I feel this way firmly, if you ever have a big score on something, let's say we give out something on the podcast and it helped you in a way that you wouldn't have had it without us, great opportunity to do this as well. Think about the equine athletes who make this whole deal possible, and put aside some money or donate some money to give to them in their time of need, their retirement. Because, you know, it's a thorny issue in American racing. It's a thorny issue in racing worldwide. And if more players could have the attitude that Brent has had, the game as a whole would be a lot better off. And since he gave his speech at the NHC, I guess it was 2 years ago now, we've seen a lot of other players follow suit. Joe Corey, when he won the big contest in South Dakota last, made a sizable donation. Jonathan has pledged donations to organizations. It's something everybody should think about doing. So I should have done that when he was on the air, and I just wanted to take a second now to do that. So we've got about 13 minutes left, and we got two things I want to talk about. The first thing is something that Mike has been tweeting tirelessly about, putting out really good information about the Rainbow Six bet, because there's just been a lot of talk about sort of the economic underpinnings of the bet and whether it's a good bet or a bad bet, or when is it a good bet. Mike, from the conversations you've been having, how would you answer those questions about when and if the Rainbow Six is a good bet?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of people that still ignore it because they feel like it is, I don't know the exact economics of it, but I do know that of the money that would normally be paid out in a regular pick six, 70% is paid back to those with six of six, and 30% is siphoned off into that jackpot.
That's after an initial 20% takeout, so it's a 44% effective takeout by my mind.
Right, and so that is why a lot of players, and understandably, have criticism of the bet. And from an industry standpoint, especially players that are just playing it once and not playing it regularly, you know, long term, and if the industry goes that way, you know, there's no way you can expect to win with effective 44% takeout. So I get that point. My feeling, though, is because it is such an ignored bet by many of the stronger players and smarter players, and because it is a bet that really encourages people to only do one caveman single ticket and not press their opinions, there ends up being some relatively large amount of inefficient wagers in the pool, more so than you would see in other multi-race pools. And so those inefficient wagers and the fact that you're not probably playing against the Brent Sumjas of the world, which, believe me, is no small thing when you're trying to make money betting horses, has shown that the bet pays quite well in comparison to the win parlay, and even better than corresponding win parlays of, say, a pick five in the same sequence. So that's more my point.
I mostly agree with you, but I want to quibble with one thing that you said. Well,
sure.
I quibble with a couple things you said. But first of all, I want to make I think the point you're making, and this comes back to a poker analogy, it's a bit like game selection in poker, where you have to think about who you're playing against. And I do take your point, Mike, that when you're playing in this pick six bet, the people playing, you've got people at the high end of the market, computer groups and whatnot, people chasing single ticket outcomes to trigger that jackpot. So you're not exactly competing against them because they're looking to have one ticket, the point that you made. And then you've also got people who are unconcerned about a 44% effective takeout. So we're talking about let's face it, the worst mugs playing. And then you've got sort of the informed bettors, the Sumges of the world, who I'm taking a pretty good guess throughout the course of that bet, unless they love something, they're not bothering. So you're taking those informed bettors out of the pool, and you're better than the worst players, and your goal is different than the best players. So I do see how that could provide some equity. But I think the point about the parlay is, I just don't think it's, I think it's an interesting barometer. It's interesting to see. I think it's pretty safe to say you don't ever want to be playing in any pick bet that is paying less than the parlay. But just because a bet is better than the parlay doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good bet, would be the one point that I wanted to sort of quibble with and make. And I don't think you can compare the pick five, because that pick five, you're looking at what it pays to five, but 25% of that pool gets paid out to four in the golf.
Well, I think it does actually make it a little bit of a similar analogy, because it's siphoning, the pick six is siphoning some of the money off to the carryover. The pick five is siphoning some of the money off to the four of five console, which, of course, if you hit, you would.
You have a much better chance of hitting, though, would be my point.
Right.
So I don't think it's really quite apples to apples.
Absolutely. It's not quite apples to apples, but again, you've got a 15% takeout on the pick five, and it is, I think, by and large, a bet that most players have embraced, whereas the pick six is the rainbow six rather is a bet that most players have not, to say the least. And I don't know, my feeling is perhaps because of that you get a little bit of additional equity.
Jonathan, what's your take on all the stuff we're yapping about here?
Mike's brought some really good points up for sure, you know, in our discussions we've had about it, and it's made me a little bit more comfortable with the bet. However, one of the biggest things that we haven't really talked about yet that I have a problem with is that money gets tied up and is taken out of churn and out of handle and out of circulation for the time that it's gone, and that's not really great. I mean, obviously I'm not an economist when it comes to horse racing. That's not my strong suit. I usually defer to, you know, my friend like Nick and those Nick Tamaro, he's got that stuff under control a little bit better. But I'm just not crazy about that portion of it. I can tell you that I'm fine with it being at Gulfstream, and I'm fine with it being there. And it's cool that they have it, and it's cool that we get the huge carryover and the big payout day, and that's all fun and dandy. But I sure as heck don't want to see it spread. I don't want it to go to California. I don't want it to be, you know, in Ira and in Louisville and you know in Kentucky. So
I think Churchill have tried it in the past, not so successfully, but I heard some rumor that they might be trying to jumpstart it this year. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But I think that's a very valid point about the economics of it. And it gets back to sort of a fundamental racing truism. Like, yes, it does hold that money, but that doesn't hurt Gulfstream, because a lot of the money being bet on that specific bet is money that would have gone elsewhere if it wasn't for the existence of the Gulfstream Rainbow Six. So it's a little bit, you see this a lot in racing where maybe a larger economic issue gets not really looked at very closely, because it's essentially not, they would probably, if I were an executive there looking at this stuff, I might say, well, you know, it's not really our problem. We've created something out of nothing. But unfortunately, when too many people have that attitude in the industry, you get very segmented. Sounds a lot like horse racing.
Right. But one thing I do want to say for sure, though, is that I don't want to sound negative, like where I'm knocking the bet, because our industry needs a lot more people, companies, tracks, taking chances, doing things that can drum up interest in the sport, drum up interest in participation. You know, I'm never going to knock them about it. It's just not for me, I don't think, unless it's the mandatory payout day, then it's an obvious time to get involved.
All right, let's take the last 5 minutes and talk about an old derby. I love the idea of doing this on our Wednesday shows, and what better derby to talk about with the great success California Chrome had over in Dubai? We'll just flash back to 2 years ago, to the 2014 Kentucky Derby. I can cheat again. I actually wrote a piece about this for the Racing Form this time, not my little unbearable lightness of betting blog. This one was in the actual DRF, so I know exactly what I was thinking going into the race. We'll start with you, Jonathan. How did you approach the 2014 Derby?
Well, this is my first year. I've heard Johnny D, a guest that's always on Steve Vick, talk about how
Johnny D. I was hanging out with him a little bit in California recently. Great guy.
Absolutely. He talked about how, and I don't even know what his original thought was. I don't know if he did six horses, but I kind of turned it into seven horses, where he does a seven-horse superfecta box with a bunch of buddies for Derby. And I looked back at all the Derbies, and I would have hit, like, since Big Brown, I would have hit every single one of them except for Mind That Bird doing seven horse superfecta boxes for lots of money. So I was like, I'm going to do it. This is going to be great. And so I did it. This was my first one, that I hit. I'd used California. I mean, I had this race figured out. I liked Intense Holiday a lot. He didn't run very well, but, California Chrome, Commanding Curve, Danza, Wicked Strong, Dance With Fate, Metal Count, and Intense Holiday were my seven horses. And, I think the super paid $15,000 for two.
$15,000.
Yeah. So that's it's an $1,800 bet. Obviously, this wasn't the greatest year to have done it, but it worked out well. I mean, look, the biggest thing I can say about this race is that I didn't think California Chrome was going to run nearly as well as he did. He's proved me wrong. He's obviously proved us all wrong. Well, not us all wrong, but he's proved me wrong moving forward. And so that was pretty much my strong opinion. I was wrong about Intense Holiday.
Yeah, Intense. I'll just jump in there because I had the piece I wrote for the form was basically how I'd play it if it was a contest race, and I said if you just needed one winner, I said you should pick Intense Holiday. I wish I could remember all the reasons why I liked the horse, but I was clearly very enthusiastic. I think I thought it was a situation where I wasn't in love with the three favorites who were California Chrome, Danza, and Wicked Strong, and I wanted to take shots. And Metal Count was another horse I remember just thinking had the sort of grinding style to maybe do the business if the race fell apart. And then the only good opinion I had was I thought that Commanding Curve would be running late. And that ended up being my saving grace in the race, because even though I didn't like California Chrome, I wasn't I didn't want to cut off my nose to spite my face, and I was able to use him in some combination with the 37-1 long shot and basically just get lucky using California Chrome as another horse in the race. Obviously, looking back at it, you know, would it have killed me to try to hit that exacta, which actually paid $340 a few extra times? It certainly wouldn't have, but I wasn't sharp enough to do that. So my opinion, you know, I had sort of a C-plus opinion, but at least I had a horse listed in my top three who hit the board at a big number. Maybe that helped out somebody somewhere along the line. In contest, too, the thing paid $31.80 to place, so not horrible. But, Mike, how did you see this race back in the day?
Well, you know, back in the day, I saw this race as maybe a little similar in some ways to the 2008 Derby. I felt like California Chrome was sort of the down of the race. He was the fastest. He had the best tactical speed. I thought he was the fastest horse in the race. I thought he was the best horse in the race. And I thought he was the most likely winner. You know, 5-2, I guess, was a fair price, and it was helped certainly by that last-minute million-dollar bet on Candy Boy. But you know, I tried to play around and keyed California Chrome on top with a few horses that I was looking to hit the board underneath. I did not, unfortunately, have Commanding Curve, but I had some of the ones that you guys mentioned. I had Danza and Intense Holiday and Metal Count, because he was he's kind of the darling of the clockers leading up to the race that week.
Right. Yeah, vibes are so important for the Derby. It's like I almost wish I wish I'd written down more about what people were saying about various horses during the week, because it really, more than any other American race, affects the marketplace. You'll see the sort of buzz horses be shorter than you would have guessed they would be, and then that information goes in the chart, and you don't necessarily, like, I didn't really remember that looking back at this, even just a couple of years later, let alone what it must have been like looking at Derbies 5-10 years ago. So it's just another interesting thing to pay attention to and maybe maybe keep track of in terms of your notes. Mike, any other thoughts on this California Chrome Derby, or any other thoughts in general before we wrap this week's show?
No. I think it was a good one. It was a fun one with a couple good, interesting guests. I would love to have Brent back to talk. I had a bunch of questions about that you kind of teased a little bit, Pete, the next time we have him on, just his approach to handicapping, having been on the training side of things. But we'll have to save that one for next time.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that too, but I also really wanted, I figured our Rainbow Six conversation was going to get stale, and what better time to talk California Chrome's Derby than today? So he's got to get to Vegas anyway, but he was good. I think he'll come back on with us, and obviously Marcus, you know, I view him as a semi-regular, always great to hear what he has to say. Jonathan, how about you? Any closing thoughts or any further words of advice for our friend at the Horse Player World Series?
If you're in Vegas, stay away from my partner. Don't give him any drinks.
Good luck with that. Well, that'll last about 2 hours on the first day. When does the tournament begin?
Tomorrow morning, right? Let's say Wednesday. Yeah, Thursday morning. Well, Thursday morning in Vegas. Thursday normal time for the rest of the world. But yeah, tomorrow I guess Aqueduct will probably be the first race, I'm guessing.
Excellent. All right. Well, for Marcus Hirsch, for Brent Sumter, for Jonathan Kinchin, for Michael Hogan, thank you all for joining us. My name's Peter Thomas Fornatel, if you didn't catch that before. And we're going to see you on Friday. We're going to talk all about the public handicapper races and what promises to be an exciting slate of weekend action with what's being billed as a match race in Florida between Mo Heyman and Nyquist.
With eight other horses.
but you wouldn't know it from the coverage. we'll talk about that on Friday. Until then, may you win all your photos.